Hello, Ed, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is behind the latest outburst of indignation from Hamid Karzai, who is upset with the US over the Taliban opening an office in Doha, Qatar. Thomas Barfield, the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, joins us to discuss the behind-the-scenes wrangling ahead of possible peace talks on Afghanistan's future. Then we'll examine the implications of a move by the American Medical Association to declare obesity a disease. Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist and a leading expert on childhood obesity and author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity and Disease, joins us to discuss what this means for future medical treatment of a disease that afflicts one-third of America's adults, that's 78 million people, and 17% or 12 million of America's children, driving up medical costs by more than $150 billion a year. Then finally, we'll assess the defeat of the $950 billion farm bill today in the House that was voted down 234 to 195, largely because of the punitive cuts in food stamps that 50 million Americans depend on. Jim Weil, the president of the Food Research and Action Center, joins us to discuss the stigmatizing of needy Americans getting $1.50 per meal by Tea Party Republicans demanding that recipients of food stamps get jobs or have the federal money turned over to state governors to spend at their discretion. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And this row that's broken out over the Taliban opening an office in Qatar, which I take it they sort of treated, and it looked as though, and perhaps the Qataris went along with this, I don't know, but it looked as though they were opening an embassy. They had a plaque on the building that said the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and they had the Taliban flag flying above the building. And this has incensed Hamid Karzai, who is often at odds with the Americans. So how do you rate this latest outburst from him?
Well, this is typical of his sort of shoot first and ask questions later. I think probably a better approach from his point of view might have been a little more humor that that's the best they could do. They're not going to get back in government. But I think the main thing he was concerned was that they were acting like a country, and he was afraid that the United States was about to negotiate them with them as a country, a government of a country. And I think he totally misread that. But nevertheless, given that he's been highly sensitive about wanting to control negotiations with the Taliban and not having the Americans work around him, it hit a sore spot.
Well, I think your point's well taken, Thomas Barfield, because it has essentially given a lot of publicity to the Taliban, which they otherwise would not have gotten. And isn't the Taliban's greatest concern that they have to have some legitimacy, because they have so little legitimacy, the rest of the world sees them as barbarians and women torturers, it looks as if this has fallen right into their lap.
It has, but they certainly knew how to take advantage of it, because it's not clear that anybody in Afghanistan sees them as an emirate, as a viable government looking to step in. I mean, this came across as sort of, we are a government in exile, waiting to measure the room so we can move in. And I think that to some extent they were deliberately sort of overplaying their position like that, in part because they have a number of internal problems, the whole question about what do they really want, are they willing to compromise, are they willing to be part of the political situation, or do they want to really return themselves to run the country by themselves, is a really open question even within their own movement.
Well, apparently, at the urging of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the government of Qatar, the Taliban have taken the plaque off the building that said Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and they've cut down the flagpole and lowered the flag, but they haven't taken it down altogether. So to what extent are there hosts here, Qatar, who along with Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has always been a supporter of the Taliban going back to when they were in government. And so are there any sympathies there with the host government and the Saudis towards the Taliban, or have the Saudis gotten over it after al-Qaeda, et cetera?
Well, you have to remember that the Saudis actually broke diplomatic relations with the Taliban long before 9/11 because Mullah Omar insulted them. So even before the American invasion, the Saudis had sort of soured on Mullah Omar and the Taliban. I think one of the things is they may be in some sympathy with them and just didn't ask really hard questions about how, you know, what's our responsibility as sort of a neutral place to, you know, to set this up. I think there may have been some sympathy there, and therefore they didn't they really didn't think about what are the modalities here? How do we put this together? How do we be the interlocutors that bring these parties together? And I think in some ways the Taliban sort of stole a publicity march on both the Qataris and the Americans.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So just, I think it was last Tuesday that the NATO command in Kabul handed over the lead security responsibilities to the Afghan government ahead of the withdrawal of most of the foreign troops, which will be happening by the end of 2014. So this is an odd turn of events. This incident has rained on that parade, isn't it? This is something that Karzai wants to advertise, that he's in charge and the Americans are leaving.
Well, it's a little bit, and there's some people feel that Karzai believes that the Americans want to stay, and therefore he has the upper hand. I don't think he's really reading Washington politics really well, that this bilateral negotiation is not one in reality that the Afghans have a strong hand to play. After all, even when the troops are gone, it'll be the United States that's paying for their army and providing them sort of, even if they're not as large a number of troops, sort of a backup that would eventually prevent the Taliban from taking over militarily. And I think most Afghans sort of recognize that. So the idea that take your marbles and leave is actually for the Karzai regime an extremely dangerous mode. But he's of the opinion that the United States sees Afghanistan as so strategic that that they're the ones that will come back to the table. And I think one of the great dangers of that, as we saw in Iraq, is that politically, domestically, the United States might decide to wrap up its support and go.
Well, there's certainly no love lost, is there? We're between all the U.S. envoys have been so frustrated by Karzai, and at times he said stuff that it's endangered the lives of American troops, etc. I mean, they're pretty fed up with him, aren't they, across the board?
Yes, but since by the Afghan constitution, he has to step down after the 2014 elections, which are scheduled in April. Effectively, you're looking at, I think, from the American perspective, a change of leadership in less than a year. So their point of view would be that relationships are not between leader to leader, but state to state. And therefore, fundamentally, they're going to be looking at this with the government of Afghanistan and not necessarily looking at dealing with Hamid Karzai. So I'm certain there's some amount of patience there, knowing that even more critical for the Afghans in the withdrawal of foreign troops is the whole question, can power be transferred in Kabul? That would be the first time in Afghan history that it's transferred peacefully. So a lot of the Afghans are concerned, you know, because of this transfer of rulership of the country, will that move smoothly? So all of these pieces sort of come together.
So, Thomas Barfield, my understanding is that Pakistan's military and the ISI played an important role in convincing Afghan Taliban leaders to hold talks with the United States. And the U.S. is, after all, you know, they've already met secretly with them back in 2011. So it seems that the U.S. didn't get any kind of – obviously didn't get any guarantees out of the Taliban to stop killing Americans while they talk, right?
No, it's still an ongoing war. You know, this is neither side has really offered a ceasefire here. This is the beginning of negotiations. But I do think, particularly with the change of administration in Pakistan, a new civilian government taking charge, is that Pakistan may be rethinking just how advisable it is to sort of fully support the Taliban without negotiations, because they've got enough trouble within Pakistan. The so-called Pakistani Taliban are a threat to the government in Islamabad. History has sort of shown that both when Pakistan supported the Mujahideen against the Soviets and when they supported the Taliban, that that the Afghans make remarkably poor clients for Pakistan. That is, in a crunch, they don't take advice. So I think Pakistan may be concerned that it'd be better to come to an arrangement through negotiation than it would be to roll the dice to see just what could happen, because the unrest in the border provinces of Pakistan, the really horrible amount of terrorism that's taking place in Pakistan, I'm certain has caused them to rethink just how dangerous this is for themselves.
Well, you would think that it would be pretty obvious, wouldn't it, to at least to the sensible voices and people in Pakistan, that if the Taliban were to take over in Afghanistan, that would embolden the Tariq-e-Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, and they're already at war with the Pakistan government. So it's kind of mystifying as to why the Pakistan military and the ISI have supported the Taliban so much. It seems it's sort of the analogy would be, you know, feeding a guard dog and then eventually takes over the whole house and terrorizes the owner.
So it's more like feeding a tiger than a guard dog.
Right.
And yes, I think it's taken Pakistan a long time to realize that, and knowing that the foreign troops are coming out, I think they have been taking a strong look at it, and the realization that if you had civil war in Afghanistan, that would be very bad for Pakistan. I think they've probably also done a calculation that the Taliban are unlikely to simply sweep into Kabul to take over. There's sort of a lot of wishful thinking on that. Actually, if you look at Afghan insurgencies, historically, they're very good at getting rid of foreign armies that are in Afghanistan. They're remarkably poorly equipped then to get rid of the governments after the foreign troops leave. In all of Afghanistan's history, insurgencies have never gotten rid of a government that has international support. So, you know, and I think Pakistan may have realized that as well. One of the questions is, what are the Taliban thinking about the options? Do they think it's possible to get it all, or are they thinking, why don't we negotiate from a position of strength to get the best kind of deal that we can, rather than take it back to, for example, the 1990s? They pretty much destroyed Afghanistan in the civil war.
Well, today in the United Nations Security Council, Afghanistan and Pakistan traded accusations about terrorist sanctuaries on the border, and there have been artillery coming out of Pakistan into Afghanistan that's killed civilians. And there's obviously a great deal of bitterness between. I mean, it's a bit strange to me to understand how what this relationship is, even though Pakistan's obviously had enormous influence over Afghanistan. My impression is that not even the Pashtuns who make up the Taliban are particularly fond of the Pakistanis. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, Afghanistan was the only country to vote against Pakistan's entrance into the United Nations on the grounds it was an illegitimate state. It's never recognized the Durand Line border as a legitimate border, and the Taliban, when they were in power, didn't recognize that either. And historically, Kabul governments, regardless of who's been running them, have been open to power balancing politics such that Pakistan really worries that Kabul would reach out to Delhi to, you know, as a counterweight to Pakistan. But there's no love lost between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one of the things you have to realize, while there's more Pashtuns in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan, they constitute a small minority of Pakistan's 170 million people. So you've got these sort of funny balances, more Pashtuns than Afghanistan, but a small minority within the much larger Pakistani population. And so the great fear of Islamabad, too, is they have an insurgency on their own hands in Balochistan that's been running along. They certainly worry about the questions of holding the country together with the groups along the frontier that have never been happy with Islamabad's rule.
So aside from the Taliban, Thomas Barfield, you've got the Haqqani Network and you've got Hekmatyar, who's really a dangerous guy that the CIA used to support in the original Mujahideen jihad against the Soviets. And what happens to them, assuming that the Taliban, they can make some kind of deal with the Taliban and bring them into some kind of governance?
Well, one of the ironies of the Hizbi Islami, the party that Hekmatyar runs, half of that party is already in the Afghan government. A lot of Karzai's advisors are members of Hekmatyar's party. So you actually have this strange situation of a party leader running to destroy a government in Kabul and a number of his associates advising that government, holding positions and playing politics within that government. So that one's a very strange relationship. The Haqqanis, it's hard to know where they're going, but on the other hand, they've never really reached out, even during the Taliban time, to see themselves as rulers of Afghanistan. They've always cut a deal with who's ever most powerful in Afghanistan to essentially get regional autonomy, to be powerful, but without seeking to move out of their area into the urban areas or the larger agricultural areas. So it's hard to know, you know, where they would go, but they've shown probably the least interest in political deals, even though they're the ones that certainly do the most spectacular attacks on Kabul. But they've also had such a strong relationship with the Pakistani government, one doesn't really know sort of where their loyalty lies, whether it's to Mullah Omar or to the ISI.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Barfield, is the country going to return to a kind of warlordism, or do you think there's a possibility that they can have elections and create a stable government, and that the Taliban, you know, get some kind of representation in that government? They're clearly deluding themselves if they think they can take over the country. It sounds like their main sponsor is not interested in supporting them.
One of the questions is, number one, can there be a transition of power in Kabul in 2014? Is it possible to have elections? Will they be considered legitimate? Will it bring new blood into the government? People are watching that, and that's going to have important consequences for stability in Afghanistan. But one of the other things that people may be rethinking is that the government in Kabul is so highly centralized that the question of who holds the palace, who holds the presidency, you've got the whole government, which makes people very suspicious of negotiations with the Taliban. If they take over, they would have this highly centralized structure. Other people are looking, as part of this negotiation deal, perhaps change the structure of the government. So the Taliban are brought into coalitions, brought into rulerships in parts of southern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, where they have more sympathy, but that they don't necessarily are not necessarily involved in a central government. And one of the ways to do that would be to devolve the central government so that not everything runs through the palace. And that would begin to secure the support of people in other parts of the country who also worry about who's going to be the leader. But if they control their own destiny more, then they may be less concerned about what's going on in Kabul. Right now, essentially, even though Karzai is a president, it's pretty much modeled on the Afghan constitution of King Zahir Shah. It's a constitution for a king. he appoints everybody, which is why people are concerned about it. But one of the things that Afghans may be rethinking is perhaps if the structure were changed a little bit, there would be some circuit breakers, so to speak. So if the Taliban were powerful or had the governor of Kandahar, people in Afghanistan would be, in other parts of the country, be less concerned if they had similar control in their own parts of the country. Not to go back to warlordism, but to go back to a situation where there's a little bit more balance, and then Kabul sort of is a mediator between the different regions, that it sort of handles a lot of the things that a state should do, but doesn't micromanage the politics of the whole country.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back examining the implications of a move by the American Medical Association to declare obesity a disease.